Chapter 22, An Inquisitive Princess. The British Buddhist movement was very small, much smaller than I had imagined it to be when I was still in India. Because it was so small, it felt it needed to keep up its connections with the wider Buddhist world, and the Buddhist Society, as represented by Christmas Humphreys, had long made a point of laying on a reception for any prominent Asian Buddhist who happened to be visiting or passing through London, regardless of whether they were monk or layman, and regardless of the school of Buddhism to which they belonged. Before my arrival, the Sangha Association had honoured only Theravadin monks in this way. I was therefore not surprised to learn, towards the end of September, that the president and council of the society were giving a reception to two leading Thai Buddhists who were then in town, and that I was among those invited to attend the function. The two visitors were Princess Poon Diskil, the cousin of the King of Thailand, and Mr. Ayem Sangavasi, President and Honorary Secretary, respectively, of the World Fellowship of Buddhists. And the reception was held at the Society's premises in Eccleston Square. Princess Poon was no stranger to London, as she reminded her hosts and the other guests when replying to Christmas Humphreys' words of welcome. She had first visited the society in 1930 with her late father, Prince Damrong, while her uncle, the late King Chula Longkorn, had been a patron of the original Buddhist Society of Great Britain and Ireland in 1907. Toby was obviously gratified by these references to the present Buddhist Society's history, as he had a strong sense of tradition and was particularly proud of the Society's links with the Thai royal house. What the purpose of her present visit was, Princess Poon did not say, but knowing that she and Sangavasi were already preparing for the Fellowship's next conference — conferences were held every 2 years, each time in a different Asian country — I assumed the pair were in London to consult with Christmas Humphreys, who I believe was one of the vice presidents of the fellowship, about the choice of venue. The World Fellowship of Buddhists had been founded at Kandy, Ceylon, in 1950 by Dr. G.P. Malalasekera, the distinguished author of the Dictionary of Pali Proper Names, who some years later became the ambassador for Ceylon in the USSR, where he had persuaded the state publishing house, so he once proudly told me, to print 40,000 copies of a Russian translation of the Dhammapada. Short, plump and amiable, Malalasekera invariably dressed, at least when abroad, in traditional Sinhalese costume, consisting of white sarong, long white overshirt and a sort of embroidered stole. He and I had corresponded during my Kalimpong days, when we were both being violently attacked in the pages of the fanatical but mercifully short-lived Theravadin Buddhist paper The Buddhist World. But it was not until our paths happened to cross in England that we actually met. I do not remember all the grounds on which the paper's fiercely orthodox and, as I afterwards discovered, alcoholic editor attacked Malalasekera. But one of them certainly was that he was sympathetic to the Mahayana and had, by inviting the so-called heretical Mahayanists to join his organisation, in effect recognised them as genuine Buddhists, despite their not being followers of, quote, the pure, pristine Dharma, as the editor and his associates were pleased to term the Theravada. Malalasekera was what I called a liberal Theravadin. I had no quarrel with the Theravada as such, if by Theravada one meant simply the teaching of the Buddha as contained in the Pali Canon, and there were many issues on which we were in hearty agreement, though I suspect he would have been dismayed by some of the later developments in my thinking had he lived to see them. To date, there had been 7 conferences of the World Fellowship of Buddhists, the last having taken place towards the end of 1964. It had taken place at Sarnath, near Benares, where, according to tradition, The Buddha spent the rainy season after his enlightenment explaining to his five former companions in asceticism the middle way he had discovered. Toby and Puck attended as delegates of the Buddha Society, and a brief mention of the conference appears in the former's autobiography, Both Sides of the Circle. We listened to the reports of the delegates and the splendid speeches, Toby wrote, and I played my part in the work of the committees. There was much talk of what should be done, but little of who would do it or how and when. In the official account he produced at the time for The Middle Way, he was less dismissive, though even here he spoke of tedious messages from heads of state and resolutions that were so many pious platitudes. I did not attend the conference and probably would not have attended it even if I had been in India at the time instead of being newly arrived in England. I had not attended any of the fellowship's previous conferences, though often urged to attend by friends who thought it would be worth my while to do so. It was not that I disagreed with the fellowship's ecumenical objectives, or that I was not happy to meet brother and sister Buddhists from different parts of the Buddhist world. Such was far from being the case. But experience had convinced me that gatherings of this sort were more or less a waste of time, and that I, for one, was better occupied getting on with my own work, of which, in any case, I had more than enough to keep me busy. As for meeting Buddhists from different parts of the Buddhist world, living in India as I did, I met them anyway, either at the Mahabodhi Society's Calcutta headquarters, or at one or another of the places of Buddhist pilgrimage. Some of them even made their way up to my hillside hermitage in Kalimpong. Despite my conviction that conferences were a waste of time, I might have been less disinclined to attend the Fellowship's Sarnath Conference had I still been in India, if I had not known that earlier conferences had been little more than talking shops. After the third conference, held in Burma in 1954, the delegate of a North American Buddhist group had written in some bewilderment, "I had supposed that there would be considerably more attention to devotional practices, including periods of meditation. My friends, in asking about the conference, almost invariably bring up this suggestion. The relatively small space given to devotions constituted a surprise. Am I merely betraying my Occidental and Christian background in saying that worldwide Buddhism as a vital force will never come into existence unless there is a spiritual basis more concrete than mere acceptance of a common faith?" I did not think the writer was betraying any bias. Buddhists, in fact, by virtually excluding devotional practices from the program of their conferences, showed a bias which was distinctly non-Buddhist and non-Oriental. The suggestion that we needed a spiritual basis more concrete than the acceptance of a common faith put a finger on one of the weakest points in the modern Buddhist movement of revival. It put a finger, indeed, on one of the weakest points, perhaps the weakest point, in much of traditional Buddhism, and years were to pass before I was able to identify the act of going for refuge to the Three Jewels, considered as the central and definitive act of the Buddhist life, as the concrete spiritual basis that was needed if Buddhism was to be a vital force in the modern world. Meanwhile, in the 50s and 60s, conferences of the World Fellowship of Buddhists continued to follow the type of program of which my North American Buddhist had complained. Reviewing the official report of the Fellowship's fifth conference, held in Thailand in 1958, and attended by 199 delegates, visitors and observers from 18 countries, including the host country, I wrote in the Mahabodhi Journal, "There were five plenary sessions, five business meetings, one for each subject committee, and an executive council meeting, besides a wide variety of religious, educational and social engagements. Despite the criticism which had been so often levelled against the practice, the plenary sessions were, as in previous years, mainly occupied with the reading out of messages. The committees all passed a number of praiseworthy resolutions, but without making any concrete suggestion as to how they could be implemented. As with the reports of the previous general conferences, the reader is apt to get the impression of a week of hectic sightseeing by representatives of various Buddhist organisations, or of none, followed by 2 years of complete inactivity. The present report, for instance, comes out 2 years after the conclusion of the conference. Having dealt with the last conference, I turned to the next. The WFB, which claims to be the Global Organization of the Buddhists, has been in existence for 10 years. Apart from its excellent magazine, World Buddhism, published from Ceylon, it appears to have no permanent achievement to its credit. Work on the Buddhist Encyclopedia, we understand, has practically come to a standstill. This reviewer suggests that if there is still enough life in the WFB to hold the 6th General Conference, due to meet next month, though the venue is not yet known, all concerned will be well advised to give more serious thought to the future of the organisation. The conference did not meet the following month. It met more than a year later in Cambodia, and a month before it did so, I returned to the attack in an editorial in the Mahabodhi. Having pointed out that a Buddhist organisation was not something imagined to exist in its own right, above and beyond the individuals who composed it, but simply the means of their fruitful communication with one another, I continued, "In view of the very nature of Buddhism, it is impossible that the fellowship, or any other Buddhist organisation, however widespread, should develop into a kind of superbody which would control its constituent and affiliated groups in a dictatorial manner, and think, speak, and act on their behalf. Yet surely more is expected of the WFB after more than a decade of existence than simply to assemble every 2 or 3 years for the purpose of sightseeing in the host country, listening to messages of greeting and passing resolutions it is powerless to implement. No thinking person needs to be reminded that we live in critical, even dangerous, times, when the continued existence of the human race itself is at stake. In circumstances such as these, it is imperative that the Buddhist point of view should be powerfully projected in the world, and the pacific moral influence of the Buddha's teaching brought massively to bear on contemporary issues. This year's conference should give its most serious attention to the question. The WFB urgently needs a permanent headquarters, an efficient secretariat, and a really first-class journal. Makeshift arrangements will no longer suffice. It must devise ways and means of bringing about a much closer understanding and more active cooperation between the Buddhists of the world than at present obtains. Unless such steps as these are taken without delay, the WFB will never be a force to reckon with in the world of Buddhist affairs, much less still a vital factor in the much wider, more complex and more dangerous world of the Cold War and the atom bomb. These steps were not taken, least of all by the WFB's 6th conference, held as this was in the Cambodia of Sihanouk Varma, the playboy prince, and the organisation never became either a force to reckon with in the world of Buddhist affairs or a vital factor in the wider world of international relations and power politics. Nevertheless, I continue to support the fellowship's ecumenical objectives, little as these were realised in practice, and was glad to attend the Buddhist Society's reception and to meet Princess Poon and Ayim Sangavasi, neither of whom I had met before. 2 days later, they came to see me. Princess Poon was a tiny, bird-like woman with a round, moon-like face, framed by an abundance of grey curls. She wore Western dress, as did Ayim Sangavasi, a rather small, youngish man who did not look comfortable in his dark, ill-fitting lounge suit. The princess took the lead in the conversation, her companion merely supporting her with an intervention from time to time. Every now and then they consulted together sotto voce in their own language. After we had discussed Buddhist affairs in general for a while, and I had given them a brief account of the present state of Buddhism in Britain, so far as this was known to me, Princess Poon started asking me about the activities of the Vihara and about the relations between its various resident members. In particular, she wanted to know how well Vichitta and the Thai monk, who had recently joined him there, had fitted in, and whether their behaviour had given me cause for complaint in any way. And I began to realise that my visitors had come with a definite purpose in view, and that there was something they wanted to find out. Truth to tell, neither Vichitta nor his companion had fitted in very well. They had not made the slightest effort to fit in. Of Vichitta, it could even be said that all his efforts had been directed to not fitting in, and to making it clear to everyone that although temporarily based at the Vihara, he belonged to the Thai Sangha, not to the English Sangha. To an extent, I could understand their position and even sympathise with them. So far as they were concerned, they were living in a kind of bardo, or intermediate state, waiting for the moment when they would be able to move to the temple the Thai government was building in Wimbledon, and probably saw no point in trying to adjust to a situation in which they had no personal interest and would be leaving soon. Consequently, they tended to treat the Vihara very much as a hotel, where they ate and slept when in London, Vichitta was often away, and where they received people, but with the running of which they had nothing to do. But even a hotel has its house rules, and Vichitta and his companions didn't always observe the rules of the Vihara. The rule they most frequently flouted had to do with food. Though the Vihara was vegetarian, I would often return from visiting one of the provincial groups to find in the refrigerator the remains of whole chickens they had ordered from the local delicatessen. Yet, little as the Thai monks had fitted in, and much as their behaviour had given me cause for complaint, I was reluctant to apprise Princess Poon of the true state of affairs. The very idea of informing in this way on my two guests, who, after all, were fellow monks, was repugnant to me. Besides, though Princess Poon was clearly anxious to know how well Vichitta and his companion had fitted in, and whether their behaviour had given me any cause for complaint, why she should want to know this was not clear at all. Were she and Sangavati trying to find out what kind of attitude I had towards their monks? Or were they looking for a handle against the monks themselves, whether because they came from a monastery that was out of favour with them, or because they belonged to a different faction within the Thai Buddhist establishment? Thai Buddhist politics were, as I knew, extremely complicated. There were wheels within wheels within wheels. There was also the question of face to be considered. Face was no less important to the Thais than to the Chinese, and if it was known that I had complained about them to two such prominent and influential people as Princess Poon and Sangavasi, the two monks might suffer a serious loss of face, both in their own eyes and in the eyes of their compatriots. These thoughts all flashed through my mind in an instant, and I therefore simply gave my visitors to understand that the Thai monks had fitted in reasonably well, and that I had no complaints regarding their behaviour. Though I must have known many of the guests at the Buddhist Society's reception, the only people I actually remember meeting there, apart from Dr. Malala Sakera, are Morris and Ruth Walsh. I remember meeting them because they had just spent 5 weeks in Japan, and I had not seen either of them since their return. At that time, few English Buddhists had visited Japan or knew very much about Japanese Buddhism, apart from Zen, and Morris soon wrote for The Buddhist a lively and informative article entitled "All Is Not Zen in Japan." Ruth did not write about their experiences, but she talked to me a lot about them. In particular, she spoke about the visits she and Morris had paid to the Soto Zen Monastery, where Peggy Kennett, a former member of the Buddhist Society, was staying and practicing Zen, and where they had a long discussion with her teacher. Kind-hearted Ruth was very concerned for Peggy. Her teacher, who was the abbot of the monastery, had seemed very displeased with his English disciple. "He kept scolding her in front of us," Ruth exclaimed in shocked tones. What she and Morris had not realized, and I think never did realize, was that the abbot was scolding not Peggy, but them. He was scolding them for their wrong views about Zen, views which she supposedly was mirroring for their benefit. Mirroring played an important part in Japanese education and culture. Basically, it consisted in reflecting a child's or a disciple's misbehavior or misunderstanding back to him by mimicking it in such a way that he was shamed into conformity. 4 or 5 years later, when she returned to the West as Jiyu Roshi, Peggy's attempts to introduce this typically Japanese technique into the culturally very different world of British Buddhism had some amusing consequences.